Welcome to the latest episode of the Custom Private Equity Podcast, Private Equity in the 1980s. Today, we will talk with Paul Anthony Thomas, the principal at CustomPrivateEquity.com. I'm Ron Davis, experienced podcaster, and I'll be asking all the newbie questions. So, Paul, now we're finally getting into an era that I remember, you know, that time of big hair and parachute pants, neither of which I had, of course, but, you know, it'll be an interesting time to talk about. So what were the 80s like?
Well, Ron, I appreciate you being here today. The 1980s were kind of a tumultuous decade. We had really high inflation. The average inflation was somewhere between 8 and 12%, but we had inflation, record inflation in the 80s. We also had unemployment declining, so the economy was actually kind of booming, but we had a huge oil depression during the 80s, during the middle time of the 80s. We'll kind of talk about this in detail. And then we also saw the startup of the Resolution Trust Corporation, which it actually didn't form until the early 1990s, but the precursor to it, which was the savings and loan crisis and the crash of the Continental Illinois Bank and 700 other banks in the country. During this time, it was a decade of opportunity for us and also of high money prices. So,
yeah. And I remember a number of, you know, big events that were happening. You know, we started out the decade with the Iran hostage situation, where we had an embassy taken over by people in Tehran for over a year. It was a long time.
That's right. By 1981, economists and businessmen had gotten tired of stagflation in the 70s and had turned to Ronald Reagan and his Reaganomics view of creating lower taxes and trickle-down economics. So he was a trickle-down economist and thought that if he lowered taxes and put money in the hands of the American public, that economic effect would trickle down into the U.S. economy and actually make the economy grow or more prosperous. It really never worked very well during that period of time. Reagan was the president during the middle 8 years of the decade. The economy grew from federal spending, so that was interesting. The budget deficits tripled during the time frame, and we saw serious droughts in the U.S. during that time in 86 and also in 88. So the farmers suffered greatly. We saw the oil business decline from over $100 a barrel relative to today, adjusted for inflation, down to below $40 a barrel, adjusted for inflation. The real numbers back then were from above $42 a barrel down to $6 a barrel, the real dollars during those years. We had an oil glut in the early part of the decade from 82 to 84. Then towards the end of the decade, we had the Continental Illinois Bank. It was the first bank to crash, leading up to what we call the Resolution Trust Corporation. During that period of time, over 750 banks actually crashed late in the decade. And unemployment was high coming out of the 70s, but then it fell to about 5% late in the decade. The Berlin Wall fell, which was one of the greatest events to ever happen during any economic time. Al Qaeda actually started during the decade. Tiananmen Square happened late in 89. The world population grew from 4 billion people in the late 70s to over 5 billion people during the late part of the 80s. So we had routine space shuttle missions. We had the Challenger explosion in 86 off the launch pad. But what was interesting in the conversation we were having is that the space shuttle continued to fly until 2011, mm-hmm. which we thought that would never happen. But it was the only form of transportation into space at the time. And we were building the Hubble Space Telescope during that time. And we also had the space station that we're building. Yeah. So we had to have transportation into space to keep the space program going.
You know, the other thing that's kind of goes underneath all of this is the Cold War. I mean, it started before, but there was this feeling all through the 60s, 70s, 80s that there could be nuclear war at any time. And by the end of the 80s, that's kind of what the symbolism of the Berlin Wall coming down in 89 was, that the Cold War was over. We weren't pointing all these nuclear missiles at one another. And that's like a sort of a fundamental shift in people's psyches, right? Like that was the big threat. That was that big existential threat that hung over everybody.
So in today's world, because the Berlin Wall came down, we think in the business world, I think that the actual threat of nuclear disaster is worse today than it was back then. But I don't know that everybody believes that, but I believe that. I believe that rogue nations can get a hold of nuclear weapons, and they can cause issues that we have absolutely no control.
I'd say terrorism is probably the thing that, at least until we had this giant pandemic, was the underlying existential threat that people have had then.
During the decade of the 80s, AIDS came out. It was a tremendous race to the cure for AIDS. And China had the one baby policy. So now that was actually introduced today in the news, that China is seeing that their workforce is not replenishing itself because of their one child policy for the last 40 years has caused them not to have enough young people.
Yeah, they actually repealed it, and they're still finding that their people aren't having more children.
One of the big things that happened during the 80s was Chernobyl in Russia, and that actually put a huge damper on nuclear energy growth. Mount St. Helens erupted. We had the Exxon Valdez happen during that period of time, and that's when we first started really discussing global warming, was in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. Rap music was real popular, and heavy metal was born during the 80s. We had TV shows like Cosby and Roseanne, Family Ties, Married with Children, which you still see reruns of that today. And during the end of the decade, the economy kind of regained its footing, and we saw the Resolution Trust Corporation come into being, and that's when some tremendous investments were made, and the investing world actually kind of turned on its end during that period of time, during the late 80s.
So can you explain what the Resolution Trust was?
So during the middle part of the 80s, the savings and loans around the world and several of the banks around the U.S., North America, loaned a lot of money to the oil and gas business and to the energy business in general. And the energy prices fell in 1986 from the equivalent of $40 a barrel to $10 a barrel or less, and caused tremendous numbers of bankruptcies, and it took the banks down. Well, the government stepped in and they formed a corporation to buy all those bad loans and bad assets. And they bought real estate that was going under foreclosure, and they bailed out the savings and loans. So the savings and loans had lent billions of dollars to the energy business and to the real estate business. And when the energy business crashed, the real estate business crashed as well. And we saw times and I'll talk about this in the next episode, but we saw times where we could buy condominiums in Dallas, Texas for a $100 bill that sold 5 years earlier for $50,000. So the Resolution Trust Corporation took on this bailout of the savings and loans and the real estate and some of the real estate investment trusts. They bailed out Chrysler during this time. The car sales declined so far that Chrysler was going bankrupt. And that was what the Resolution Trust Corporation was all about. And it happened. It was formed in the mid 1991 and actually ran until about 1996. And we were active during that period of time, trying to buy assets and put pools of money together to buy assets during that time.
So this trust just went and bought the loans from the savings and loans, like just gave them the money and then they owned those assets. What happened sort of long-term to those assets? They turn around and try and sell them, and that's when you're seeing these deals?
Yes, they turned around and they got private investors to come in and buy up those assets. The people on Wall Street made billions. In the investing world, we saw that the Fed drove interest rates up to 20% in 1982. That's when the highest level of interest rates we've ever seen. But then the rates went down to about 8% towards the end of the decade. So money was expensive during that period of time. But the high interest rates, if you were getting paid 20% interest from the bank, you weren't really interested in going out and investing much in private equity deals. So the early in the decade, private equity was all about the tender offer and about takeovers and corporate hostile takeovers. And and management buyouts and things like that. Towards the end of the decade, then we saw the pools of money, the private equity pools of money, go in and start buying assets from the federal government that they had repossessed from the savings and loan. Inflation was very high during that period of time, during the early part of the decade. Inflation dipped down because the price of crude oil declined so far that inflation dipped down from 14% early in the decade to 1% during the middle, and then stabilized around 5% towards the end of the decade. So
we're seeing interest rates change. We're seeing inflation change. Nowadays, we tend to think those two things are very much connected. But what were you seeing, and what do you think about the inflation numbers that happened in the 80s?
So inflation, the calculation of inflation changed dramatically during the late 80s and early 90s. And I'll discuss that a little bit here. So since the 80s, inflation calculations have been altered radically in the U.S. government. We consider that the inflation numbers are nowhere near accurate that come out of the government. And the government has done that on purpose because Social Security raises and the government's budget are tied directly to this consumer price index, the CPI. And so they had to do something in the 80s because Social Security was starting to lose its wherewithal in the 1980s. They had to do something in the 1980s to keep the raises, the consumer price index, under control and keep the raises that they were having to give retirees for Social Security, keep those to a minimum. The largest piece of the pie was 43% was in the housing index. And they've actually removed that part and replaced it with the rents. And then in 1992, they tied on a thing onto the consumer price index called hedonics. And hedonics is where they compensate for technical advances. And it's actually reduced the consumer price index greatly. And also then, and we'll talk about this in our next episode, but in 1999, they started allowing substitutions where you could substitute hamburger meat for steak. We consider that when the CPI, the consumer price index, is at 2%, and they consider that to be the nominal inflation rate, that we consider inflation to be at about 10%. So that's the disconnect. And I talk about this at length in some of my videos on our website, is that there's a huge disconnect between what the government says inflation is and what true inflation is. So today they think it's about 2%, the government inflation number is about 2%. I calculate that inflation in today's world is somewhere between 10 and 12%. So you can imagine how much that would affect how you look at investments.
And what are you basing your inflation numbers on?
So our inflation numbers are based on the actual price of living. So the consumer price index is the same basket of goods have been used for the last 40 years. And they've done some alterations to it, like I just discussed. But that basket of goods has changed dramatically. The inflation indicator that we use is, we call it the McDonald's index or the Big Mac index. So you could have bought a Big Mac in 1985. Basically, you could have bought a Big Mac for $1.25. Today, that same Big Mac costs you $5.80. So that's an example of the inflation that's happened since 1985. The average new house cost in 1985 was $76,000. Today, that new house cost in most of the U.S. is somewhere around $175,000. So that's a three times indicator. And the new house quality, in our opinion, has come down dramatically. So the problem they were having is every 4 or 5 years, the electronics world was changing so dramatically in a matter of 4 or 5 years. And so in the 80s, it was the Walkman that was big and VCRs. And then we went to CDs and compact disc. And there was several iterations between that. And then now we're up to telephones. So mm-hmm. every 10 years, every 5 to 10 years, the computer age and the computer electronics world reinvents itself and advances itself so far that we couldn't use the same basket of goods because the Walkmans don't exist anymore. Right. Nobody makes a Walkman anymore. Can't even hardly buy one anymore. So now you're buying thumb drives with terabytes of data storage on them. And or $1,000 every 2 years for a new iPhone. Well, how do you put that into a basket of goods that's 40 years old? Back in the 80s, popular computers were the Compaq, the 286 and 386. The Apple Macintosh was actually introduced in the 1980s. So the problem the government has is, and trying to calculate inflation during this entire period, and this is why we don't use the government numbers anymore, is because the government has not been able to devise a system to keep up with inflationary numbers and inflationary activities in a world that moves so fast. We've seen the advance of things like video games from Atari and Sega, and now we have, I mean, back in the 80s, we had Space Invaders was the big game back then, and Super Mario was introduced.
Most of that development's happening now on the PlayStation and the Xbox, right? With a little bit of Nintendo in there, too. Not to mention a lot of it's happening on mobile phones. Like there's another thing, right? All computing has become the phone.
During the 80s, VCRs were very popular. Now you can't even hardly buy a VCR. During the 80s, we could build a cable system and double our money on that cable system. So we could build a cable system over a 2 year period of time and sell it to somebody. And if we took a $10 million to build it, we could sell that cable system within a year for $20 million. Very interesting times. MTV debuted in 81, and that kind of started the introduction of video into the world. And we had some big IPOs during the 80s. We had 3Com and Adobe. Anadarko was a big oil company. Apple IPO'd during the 80s. Best Buy, Big Lots. Cracker Barrel came out. Dell Computer. The FICO score was actually invented during the 80s, which is what drives credit today. It's a tremendous, tremendous thing. Home Depot came out, Jack in the Box, Kate Spade, LA Gear, Microsoft IPO'd during the 80s, LabCorp, Oracle, big computer companies today, their old hat today.
So what was private equity like back in the 80s?
Well, in the early part of the 80s, it was driven by leveraged buyouts, and then it went to management buyouts, and the number of leveraged buyouts during the 80s hit over 2,000. There were 2,000 leveraged buyouts during that period of time. And they were driven by junk bonds. Michael Milken and the Drexel Burnham guys sold billions of dollars of low quality bonds. We talked about that a little bit. It started late in the 70s and then actually got its feet under it in the 80s. Went to management buyouts. And then the last big leveraged buyout was when RJR Reynolds bought Nabisco, and they paid several billion dollars for them. The leverage buyouts of the 70s were low dollars. They were $250 million or lower. The leverage buyouts of the 80s went up into the billions of dollars. We saw Beatrice sold for $6 billion, Safeway sold for $5 billion. Billion-dollar buyout today is not that big a deal, but $6 billion in 1985 is equivalent to $40 billion today. So they were pretty large buyouts back then. Revco Drug was a management buyout. Transworld Airways, Payless Cashways, TWA doesn't exist anymore. Gulfstream, that's a big company today. Marvel Entertainment, that's a huge. They were actually rated by a guy named Ron Perlman. He rated that company and actually took it over under a hostile takeover. And then in 1989, RJR bought Nabisco, and that was done by Colbert Kravitz. We had some startups, notable startups in the 80s were Tandem, Apple, Electronic Arts. A guy named Trip Hawkins started that company. He left Apple in 82 and started Electronic Arts, huge corporation today. Federal Express, Compaq.
All right, so we've got all these leveraged buyouts going on. Who were the people doing those corporate ratings?
Well, Carl Icahn was one of the biggest guys, and Boone Pickens did his share. He bought out Unocal and City Service and Gulf. Harold Simmons bought out Eckerd Drug and actually formed a big drug buyout company. Ron Perlman, he rated Revlon. He bought Technicolor. He bought Pantry Pride, which is a big meat processing company. Warburg and Pincus joined up, and they were big buyout specialists. Drexel, with Michael Milken and his team, their bankruptcy, they went bankrupt late in the 80s, and their bankruptcy took 4 years to unwind. General Electric was a big buyout specialist. They actually bought lots of companies during that period of time. During late in the decade, Continental Illinois Bank financed some of these buyouts, and later on in the decade, the buyouts got so expensive that they started failing. They almost failed before they were finished. And that was also a part of the startup to the Resolution Trust Corporation, because the savings and loans were providing a lot of this financing. The companies fought those off fiercely with using green mail, where they'd actually bribe the takeover company to leave them alone. Later in the decade, other companies that came to fruition was Bain Capital, which was one of the founders of that company, was Mitt Romney. Chemical Bank was a huge bank that was actually financing those. In Texas, we had a company called Hicks Muse. Blackstone was started then, the Carlyle Group. So basically what happened is the leverage buyouts made these groups so much money, there weren't any more companies to buy. So they had to go start companies. And that's where the venture capital world started up. And this happened in the mid-80s. And the venture capital world during the 1980s grew from a $3 billion industry to a $30 billion industry. It grew a tenfold factor in a matter of 10 years over the decade of the 80s. Basically, we saw the chip makers start taking over the computer world. So they were making chips and starting to stack silicone chips on top of each other in the micrometer, or called a micron size. And then they went down, and late in the 80s, they went down to 600 nanometers. So they went from 1,000 nanometers to 600 nanometers in size during that decade, from 85 to about 90. And now they're talking about 5 nanometers. So they were in the late 80s, they were at 600 nanometers, and now they're at 5 nanometers. So the chip world is what has driven the technology, the world of technology. And you have chip makers like Motorola and Philips. And in 75, it was Texas Instruments. In 85, it was Motorola and Philips. And then by late 80s, it was Toshiba and Hitachi. These are all household names now, but back then they were big startup companies. And the Intel was one of the biggest ones in the mid 70s. And then Intel is still a driver of the business today. We don't really follow the retailers too much. We follow the people who drive the tech world, and that's the chip makers.
So what type of private equity deals were you doing in the 80s?
Well, we've always traded in the startup private equity world and small company acquisitions. And we do acquisitions of $2 million companies to $10 million companies is kind of our bread and butter. And we actually do more startups today than we did back then, back in the 80s. But we keep our finger on the pulse of emerging technologies. And we also like cash flow. So we like stable, hard asset portfolios. We like We have an offering on the street today for self-storage. We consider self-storage to be the strongest area in the commercial real estate marketplace. We have an offering on the street to buy up oil and gas assets during a decline. So we were in the 80s, we were doing oil and gas exploration. We were wildcatters. My father was a wildcatter, and we drilled oil wells from Calgary, Canada to San Antonio, Texas. So we had offices in Baton Rouge. We had an office in Oklahoma City. We had an office in Denver. We did real estate development and management. We do quite a lot of that today. And we actually converted from the stock market more to commodities during that period of time. We published a newsletter. We were publishing our New Horizons for Investors newsletter for the first 5 years of that decade. But then we started publishing a newsletter called Super Trends. If you really want to make serious money, you get in on the early part of a trend and you follow that trend over 2 or 3 decades. We actually opened our first broker dealership in the early 1980s, and I was the principal and compliance manager for that broker dealership. So we were also doing that kind of work as well.
So what types of deals did you manage in the 80s?
So guided by my father's 50 years of experience and putting my 20 years of education and research to work, we had a really busy time during the 80s. As I said, we had a oil and gas office in Baton Rouge and Oklahoma City and Denver. We drilled and sold prospects, oil and gas prospects, over 300 wells during that period of time, during that decade. We worked from Calgary. We worked in the Williston Basin, the DJ Basin, Green River Basin, Powder River, Michigan, Kentucky, Tennessee. We worked in Pennsylvania, did mining geology. Actually, my father and I were both geologists. We did coal mining in North Dakota, and we did coal shaft mining work in West Virginia. we did research, deep research into aggregate mining and building products, logistics. Actually, during the late part of the decade, I started my own trucking company, a small trucking company. We did mobile CT scanners. We did research into that, steel recycling and steel foundries. We did a lot of research into rural healthcare. That's where the mobile CTs came in. We designed a system where we actually put CAT scanners into 18-wheel trucks, and we would take those out to the rural areas of the country. We did industrial warehousing research and learned about, that's where I learned a lot about industrial warehousing from Trammell Crow and his family. I met Trammell Crow and tried to partner up with him on a few things. Some cable systems. We actually did some work on radio stations. I actually did some pretty deep research into NASCAR and the dynamics around NASCAR, because NASCAR was big in the 80s. We did deep research into assisted living. I actually became certified to run an assisted living facility during that period of time. So anytime that we get involved in something like that, we will go actually far enough into the business to actually be able to run the business. Whatever certifications need to be taken down, we'll do the research and have the education behind us to do that. We had a large concession in Australia. It was a 100,000 acre oil and gas mineral concession in Central Australia. Oil went from an inflation adjusted $140 a barrel during the decade down to below $31 a barrel, which in real dollars was $40 a barrel to below $6 a barrel in 83. We worked our way through that deep recession and we're buying oil and gas properties towards the end of the decade from the savings and loan workout. During that period of time, during bankruptcy, the oil and gas bankruptcies, we were researching oil and gas auctions similar to what we're doing today. We're doing that same research today. We researched over 200 oil and gas auctions during that period of time, and we're actually buying and selling oil and gas equipment during that period of time. I worked on environmental activities. The EPA was actually started during the late 70s and early 80s, and I worked on as a contractor for Superfund and the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, RCRA. I also did a detailed research and actually ran the solid waste department for the EPA in the 90s in the Region 6 in Dallas. Opened my first restaurant during the 1980s. That was a real fiasco. I do know quite a lot about food service. Bell Labs was big in coming out of fiber optics, and fiber optics became a gold mine during the late 80s. You could build a fiber system anywhere and sell it and double your money. In some areas in large cities, you could build a fiber system and triple your money during that period of time. We expanded our Forex, our foreign exchange practice, and we saw the peso devalue in the early 1980s by 1,000% overnight. I had a friend that went from $100,000 net worth, $100,000 in savings, to $9,000 overnight in the peso. That entrenched my understanding of hard assets and cash flow and how those things work together to actually prevent the devaluation of currencies, like we've had devaluation of the dollar over the last four decades. Hard assets prevent that from happening to your holdings. So that's one of the reasons we deal in hard assets today. We did extensive research in the biomedical world. I took immunology classes and studied immunology in detail, life sciences. When I first started in college, I started as a biology major and started the study of global warming during that period of time. The interesting thing about global warming is global warming occurs all the time. And if you look at it from a geologist standpoint and a geologist's view, you would understand that this global warming we're going through today is nothing new. During that period of time, I did deep research into alternative energy, solar, wind, hydrogen, all those alternative energy sources today. We've started researching back in the 80s and 90s. So
what were your team's strong suit back in the 80s?
Yeah, our team's strong suit's always been deep research. We had, at that point in time, I had 70 years of experience behind me. I had my father's lifetime of investing experience. Then I had my 20 years at that point in time. Now I have more than 40 years of experience. So we've moved more out of the public markets into the private markets, because you can actually have more control over the types of investments you make and the types of difference you make in your world. During the 80s, we reviewed 50 private equity investments a year. We still managed to do our research into our commodities brokerage business. I continue to research public stocks, but I don't invest in the public markets like we used to back in the 80s. We invest in the private markets, and we do things that are going to grow our wealth at a faster pace than the public markets can do with less risk.
Right, well, that is the 80s, folks. Any final words, Paul?
Our mantra continues to be that if you research and review and come away with two or three really good platforms to invest in, you've done the hard work of investment manager, and that you're going to hit home runs whenever you actually do invest capital. So that's our mantra today.
All right. If you guys want more information about today's topic, go to customprivateequity.com. There are a number of resources there, as well as multiple ways to contact Paul. Once again, that URL is customprivateequity.com.